as the Narbonne's helm officer closed the distance. "I'm fine. Just a little disoriented. What's going on?"
"No idea. But if I had to guess, I'd say some kind of overload or power surge. We're hooked into the spaceport's primary power hub, which gets fed from a distribution plant that also supplies energy to the city. If all our onboard generators and regulators are offline, this is likely a shipwide problem. I'm on my way to the bridge."
Indicating she would follow the lieutenant, Georgiou fell in behind Parham as the younger woman led the way through the dimly lit passageway that was the ship's main thoroughfare on this level. They passed other members of the crew, most of whom appeared to have gotten past their initial momentary shock and were moving to duty stations or participating in damage control parties. Georgiou overheard snippets of instructions and reports as training and procedures came to the fore and the crew turned to their various tasks.
"Captain Korapati trains you all very well," observed Georgiou.
Parham replied,
"We may not pass too many fancy inspections or be the prettiest to look at, but don't let the grungy coveralls fool you, Commander. When we have to, we can turn and burn just like any ship of the line."
As they moved forward, the more Georgiou saw that the crew's efforts were already having an effect, with at least some of the main corridor lighting being restored. Upon their reaching the bridge, all of the alarms that had been sounding in the passageways were gone, replaced by rhythmic sequences of beeps and tones as diagnostic protocols were activated on various workstations, access panels, and other control surfaces. Georgiou followed Parham through the doorway to the bridge and saw Captain Korapati standing at the center of the room, overseeing the controlled chaos around him. The smell of smoke from burned insulation, optical cabling, and other composite materials fouled the air, along with the recognizable odor of fire suppressant. Members of the ship's crew were at every station, and Georgiou saw that several screens were blown out, along with scorched control consoles and more than a few blown illumination strips.
"Welcome to the party," said Korapati upon noticing them.
Parham, moving to the helm console, asked,
"What happened, sir?"
"An immense power surge from the distribution plant. It's affected the entire spaceport and a good portion of the city as well. There are overloads and circuit burnouts everywhere, and the plant itself appears to be offline."
"What about emergency facilities?" asked Georgiou. "The hospital?"
Korapati frowned.
"We don't know if they got hit, but they have emergency generators and other backup systems if they need them. I suspect the same is true for other first response assets. Once we get everything sorted out here, we can start checking with colony administration to assess the damage."
"Looks like we got hammered pretty good," said Parham.
The helm officer had eschewed her chair and instead was leaning over her console. Georgiou could see from the rows of indicators and other readouts that the lieutenant was running status checks and collecting information being relayed to the bridge from other areas of the ship.
"We lost about 40% of our power relays," offered Commander Natalie Larson, as she stepped from the primary sensor control station along the bridge's starboard bulkhead. "There are more blown breakers than I can count. Engineering's going to have their hands full for a while."
Georgiou asked, "Aren't we shielded from this kind of thing?"
"We are, at least to an extent," replied the Narbonne's first officer.
She let her gaze drift around the bridge.
"On the other hand, this is an older ship, and we don't have state-of-the-art systems like line ships are getting. They'll likely scrap us before giving us that kind of upgrade."
Standing next to his command seat, Korapati laid his hand on the chair's armrest.
"That said, she held up pretty well, all things considered."
Larson nodded.
"True enough, sir."
For Georgiou's benefit, she added,
"Primary power distribution was knocked offline, but not damaged. Backup systems are up and running, which is good enough for now. Primaries will be back online within a half hour or so. After that, it'll mostly be overloads and burnouts that'll need replacing or rerouting until engineering can get to everything."
A hum from the front of the bridge caught Georgiou's attention, and she looked to see the main view screen coming back to life. The screen flashed a sequence of colors and then a string of indecipherable encoded text indicating the imaging software was resetting and running through its startup diagnostics. A moment later, the picture coalesced into a view of the spaceport, as though Georgiou was looking through a window in the Narbonne's bow. Almost everything was dark.
Sensors are still rebooting,
reported Commander Larson, from where she had returned to the sensor station she was using to oversee damage control and repairs.
But we've got enough to give us a look around the area. The entire spaceport went offline thanks to the surge, and at least 37% of New Anchorage is also affected.
She tapped several controls before consulting one of the console's readouts.
Commander Georgiou, the hospital looks to be running on their backup generators.
Thank you, Commander.
Georgiou frowned.
Aren't there procedures in place to prevent this kind of thing from happening? At the power plants, I mean?
Larson nodded.
There should be. The plants are supposed to have multiple redundant protocols designed to prevent surges like this from running unchecked. According to our sensors, before they were knocked out, the power surge that hit us was nearly twice what we're supposed to be receiving. Assuming the plant's safety protocols are active and there are no maintenance issues with the physical equipment, that sort of overload should be impossible, two or three times over.
So the plant that's supplying us with power while we're on the ground just happens to produce an uncontrolled energy surge, said Koropati. And we get caught in the middle of it. Am I the only one who thinks that sounds suspicious?
No, sir, replied Georgiou.
Then, recalling something she should have remembered sooner, she cursed herself and pulled her communicator from a uniform pocket.
We've got people there! Sultani and Jen. They were assisting with final inspections of the plant after the damage it took during some of the protests.
The communications array is still offline, said Larson. It'll be up in a couple of minutes.
Georgiou glanced toward the hatchway leading from the bridge.
I can go check on them myself, then.
To Koropati, she said,
Request permission for a security detail to accompany me, sir.
Our transporters are offline and won't be back for at least 30 minutes. By the time you get there, comm will be back up, replied the captain. Let's just take a breath and make sure we're not running off in all directions without a plan. If this was a coordinated strike, there may be more to it.
As though sensing Georgiou's imminent protest, he raised a hand.
If we get comm and are unable to reach the team at the plant, then you can go.
Returning to her work, Larson called out,
I think you may be onto something, Captain. Something's going on.
Both hands were working different sets of controls at the sensor station, and without looking away from the console, she continued.
We can receive incoming transmissions. I'm tapping into the city's news feeds.
She moved toward the communications station.
Ensign?
Already on it, Commander, replied Richard Doherty, the Narbonne's communications officer. We're not completely up and running just yet, but I can compensate. Pulling in one of the feeds now.
The ensign pressed another control, and the image on the main screen shifted again, displaying a well-dressed woman sitting at a desk and framed by a backdrop of the New Anchorage skyline. At the bottom of the screen was a red banner highlighting a line of white text scrolling from right to left, informing viewers of a series of unexplained explosions occurring at various points around the city. Ensign Doherty had caught the broadcast with the news anchor mid-sentence, and when she spoke, her demeanor was composed, and her tone was one of utter seriousness.
6 separate explosions have been confirmed. The targets appear to be buildings or facilities overseen by the city government, including the amphitheater, courthouse, 2 administration buildings, 1 security forces precinct, and a fire station. Authorities have no leads on who might be responsible, and no one has yet come forward to claim responsibility. Also unconfirmed is whether the incident at Power Station 2 and the problems it's caused since the unexplained power surge are connected to the bombings.
Anybody want to wager against them being connected? Asked Koropati.
Georgiou shook her head.
No, sir. And I'm betting we also know who's responsible.
A new alarm from the sensor station made them all turn to where Larson was consulting new readings being fed to her console.
There's been a breach of the force field at the spaceport perimeter. The fields are being supported by backup generators, but one of them just went offline.
She tapped another control.
I'm picking up an unauthorized vehicle entering the port grounds.
Go to red alert, ordered Koropati. Recall anyone who's still outside and secure all exterior hatches. Where is that vehicle heading?
Larson replied, Not for us, sir.
A second later, she looked away from the console.
It's heading for one of the other transports. I just scanned them, Captain. Only one was impacted by the power surge. The other one wasn't touched. Damn it, said Giorgio. Somebody's trying to run for it. Could it be Kodos? Had the fugitive governor finally emerged from hiding in a daring bid to make an escape? Koropati asked,
Do we have security people on the ground over there?
Just two, sir, replied Larson as she stepped away from the sensor console. Request permission to—
Go, snapped the captain before gesturing to Giorgio. Take the commander and the security detail. Secure that ship.
29. While the illumination from the trusty flashlight taken from her engineer's tool satchel was helpful, it did little to assuage Haley Carroll's unease.
Wow, but it's damned dark out here. And spooky, too.
The moon was somewhat helpful, casting a pallid blue veneer over everything while doing little to chase away the shadows cast by the surrounding buildings. Standing next to her, Ensign Dralax replied, I am able to see well enough even without your light. Carol could not help but smile.
Sure, wave your denobulin eyes in my face. How is it every species we humans meet ends up having something about their physiology that's superior to whatever we're born with?
She offered a grunt of mock disapproval. Life is so unfair. Whatever the biological differences between our species, said Dralax, it's not as though humanity has failed to make significant contributions to the interstellar community. You and your people have much to be proud of. She chuckled as she reached for the communicator on her equipment belt.
Sure, bring a bunch of planets together to form a club. Fight a couple of wars together. Help each other out during times of crisis. Still doesn't help me see in the dark or live... How long do denobulins live, anyway?
Our average lifespans can be as much as 300 years as measured on Earth, Lieutenant.
And you're practically immortal compared to us, too. That's just great.
She laughed to show she was having a bit of fun at her friend's expense.
And didn't I tell you to call me Haley? If we're going to be working together in the dark at all hours of the night, there's no need to be so formal.
Very well, Haley. Satisfied with her minor victory, Carol smiled. The two of them were paired together for a 4-hour shift of guard duty at the docking slips, where the port's only two civilian transports were berthed. With the Narbonne's crew stretched thin as it supported various efforts around New Anchorage, as well as the search parties currently hunting Governor Kodos, anyone and everyone who could relieve the ship's overworked security detail for guard duty and other mundane tasks was being called into service. Even medics like Dralax and the civilian members from Starfleet's Corps of Engineers were not exempt from the boring yet necessary duty, and fate had seen fit to partner Carol with the affable denobulin. In truth, the walk with Dralax from the Narbonne was the most time she had spent with him since being assigned by Admiral Anderson to the ship and the Tarsus IV response team at Starbase 11. There had been little opportunity for socializing en route, with every member of the ship's baseline and extended crews focused on various preparations so they could be ready to render aid upon making planetfall. After the ship's arrival, everyone had turned to one task or another, working all hours of the day and night. The medical personnel in particular had been very busy, to the point that most of them, Dralax included, were taking brief sleep periods at the New Anchorage Hospital.
We'll have at least 4 hours to get acquainted, assuming this little power hiccup isn't anything serious. Carol to Narbonne, she said into her communicator after flipping it open.
Static was the only reply to her call, which she repeated with the same result. She turned the device over in her hand, removing its back cover and inspecting its internal components.
There's nothing wrong with it. The problem must be on their end.
Dralax had also attempted to contact the ship with his own communicator and was no more successful than Carol. He said, Perhaps the Narbonne was affected by whatever has caused the spaceport to lose power. The two of them were walking from the ship toward the spaceport's other berthing spaces when darkness descended upon the entire area. Every exterior light and any visible illumination inside the surrounding buildings was extinguished, and Carol heard the sound of an alarm as the force field encircling the spaceport failed. That was followed moments later by backup generators kicking in to ensure the field's continued operation, but power to the exterior lights was slower in returning, for reasons she did not understand. Faint glows were visible in some of the nearby lamps positioned along the walking paths and the service roads utilized by ground vehicles. In the distance, she could see the berthing spaces for visiting ships coming back to life.
Shouldn't take this long, should it?
We should keep heading to the docking slips, she said. Maybe the guys we're relieving will know something.
That seems a prudent course of action, replied Drelax, as the pair resumed walking in the direction of the docking berths. The path they traversed led them past one of the spaceport's equipment hangars, which Carol knew from her initial inspection was used for servicing small atmospheric craft and the one-person work pods used to deploy, retrieve, and service satellites in orbit around the planet. Beyond that structure, she could see the metal columns and immense sections of thermoconcrete forming the port's perimeter wall. On the wall's far side was the reassuring orange-yellow glow of the force field, which appeared to once again be operating at full strength following its brief interruption. One of the spaceport's secondary entrances was also visible, connected by a paved surface from the wall to the rest of the open tarmac at this end of the massive field. As for the hangar, its external lighting was restored, and she saw a few people milling about outside one of the open hangar doors. Inside the bay was a pair of work pods and an atmospheric skiff in various states of assembly. Carol smiled, understanding and sympathizing with the crew assigned to such tasks at all hours of the day and night. The spaceport, like a starship, was in a constant state of operation. Something, a new sound from somewhere near the wall, caught her attention, and she saw the section of force field protecting the nearby entrance wink out. It was followed by the revving of an engine, and then Carol caught sight of the ground vehicle bearing down on the entry's metal gate arm. The vehicle's running lights were not active, cloaking it in the near darkness until it passed beneath one of the lamps overlooking the service road. "Drelax?" was all she could muster before the vehicle crashed through the gate, wrenching it from its base and sending it flying away from the road to land in the nearby grass. The vehicle's speed did not diminish, but instead increased as it passed through the entry and on to the spaceport tarmac. Its arrival was not going unnoticed, as alarms began shrieking across the field within seconds of the breach. New lights snapped on across buildings and from lamps along the service road, adding brighter, more intense illumination to the entire area. The large, almost tank-like vehicle was plainly visible as it sped along the road, turning at the first intersection and accelerating as it headed directly for the berthing slips.
And the two transports docked there. Holy shit!
Come on, she said, pulling at Drelax's arm as she started jogging after the vehicle. The Denobulan fell into step beside her, and Carol increased her pace, holding her satchel at her side and watching as the vehicle turned from the service road onto a connecting path toward the nearer of the two occupied docking berths. She changed direction, running across the grass in a bid to make up ground, but they were 100 meters away, and the vehicle was still moving.
"We cannot hope to overtake them," said Drelax.
Carol replied,
"No, but we can try to help whoever's at the gate when they get there."
Even from this distance, she could see the gate separating the roadway from the docking slip, and two figures emerging from a small building near the entrance. Thanks to the glow of lamps above the building, she recognized the Starfleet uniforms they wore. Beyond them, and inside the docking area, other people were moving about, dressed in different civilian attire. They had to be spaceport workers, perhaps dispatched following the power outage to assess damage. The vehicle was not slowing down. Joel Pekaski braced himself against the bulkhead of the personnel carrier's passenger compartment as his driver accelerated, pushing the machine ever faster toward the gate. Through the forward canopy, Pekaski saw two Starfleet officers drawing their weapons and taking aim, then throwing themselves out of the way to avoid being hit before the vehicle smashed through the docking slip's entry gate.
"What the hell are you doing?"
snapped one of his Starfleet prisoners, who had given his name as Sultani. Both he and his companion, a woman named Ina something Jen, were doing their best to keep from being thrown from their own seats while their arms were secured with restraints behind their backs. Ignoring Sultani, Pekaski kept his attention on the forward canopy.
"Keep going."
He reached for a passenger strap dangling from the compartment's ceiling as the driver guided the carrier into a right turn. The impact with the gate had not slowed the vehicle at all, its heavy metal plating more than a match for the far weaker barrier placed before the entry. In the wake of the power surge, this phase of the operation carried the greatest risk. The distractions caused by the overloads and the other explosions set off by members of his team would buy him precious little time. The Starfleet ship was likely in the midst of recovering from whatever setbacks the surge may have inflicted. Unlike its civilian counterparts here in the spaceport, the Narbonne would be shielded from such occurrences to a greater degree, and even a vessel not intended for space combat would still have systems designed to remain functional if ever it found itself in such a situation. Its crew, likewise, would be trained and prepared to handle unexpected crises like this, perhaps more so than the spaceport personnel. Even if the ship itself was in no condition to act against this new infiltration, its crew could still be deployed as a defensive measure.
"So we need to get the hell out of here, now."
"We're here," shouted the driver, Benjamin Islip, and Pekaski felt himself pulled to the right as the carrier turned left and began braking. Even before the vehicle came to a stop, Pekaski was pressing the control to open the hatch at the rear of the passenger compartment. Essentially a fortified ramp, the hatch swung down from its frame, its far edge clanging against the tarmac and allowing light from the nearby lamps to flood the vehicle's interior.
"Let's go!"
Pekaski was the first through the open hatchway, brandishing his phaser rifle and aiming back the way they had come. He saw two figures in Starfleet uniforms and fired without warning. His first shot caught one of the figures and spun him around, dropping him to the ground as his companion lunged to his left in search of cover. Pekaski's second shot caught him on the run, and the man collapsed to the tarmac in a clumsy heap. Shouts of warning from somewhere ahead of the carrier were echoing in the night air and bouncing off the docking slip's thermoconcrete walls. Pekaski turned toward the new sounds as Islip, exiting the vehicle's driver compartment, dropped to one knee and brought up his own phaser rifle. Ahead of Islip, at least three figures wearing what Pekaski recognized as security forces uniforms were emerging from a service passage at the docking berth's far end, weapons drawn. One of the officers managed to get off a shot before Islip returned fire. That was enough to send the new arrivals scrambling, though two of the men fired poorly aimed shots in the carrier's general direction. Pekaski turned back to the carrier to see the other two members of his team leading Soltani and Jen to the ground. Turning his phaser rifle on the two Starfleet officers, he waved to Islip.
"Go and get them. I've got these two."
Keeping to the plan, Islip led the other two men away from the vehicle and deeper into the docking bay, leaving Pekaski standing with his two prisoners.
"What's this all about?" asked the woman, Jen.
Once again, Pekaski opted not to answer, and instead looked past her to see Hisayo Fujimura descending the ramp. Her face was a mask of worry.
"We can't stay here," she shouted.
Wielding a phaser pistol in her left hand, she was holding her satchel close to her right hip. The bag contained her portable computer, the instigator of the evening's events, and it had one more task to complete before they were well away from New Anchorage and Tarsus IV. Pekaski offered her a grim smile.
"Don't worry, we're not. Come on."
With the front of his phaser rifle, he indicated for Soltani and Jen to begin walking toward the docking bay.
"Move!"
"Hey!"
There was no time to react to the new voice behind him before Pekaski heard and saw the first phaser beam streaking past his right shoulder. He pivoted, bringing around his rifle toward the new threat, and saw two more Starfleet officers near the berthing area's gate. Without waiting, he fired as they came abreast of their two stunned companions, and they dropped to the ground. One of them, a female, had taken a knee while aiming in his direction. Her male partner was also crouching near one of his fallen comrades with a phaser in his hand. The woman was the more immediate threat, so he fired at her. She realized too late that he was not backing down or surrendering, and by then his phaser beam struck her left arm. She spun and fell unconscious to the tarmac.
"No!"
shouted Soltani from behind him, but Bukowski was already taking aim at the remaining Starfleet officer, who was trying to use one of his unconscious friends for cover. He could not hide, though, and Bukowski's next shot took him high in the chest, and he pitched forward, coming to rest atop his already stunned companion.
"Tell me you didn't kill them!"
snapped Jen. She glared first at Bukowski and then to Fujimura, who stood nearby, covering her and Soltani with her phaser as she had throughout the brief firefight. Bukowski shrugged.
"I didn't kill them. They're just stunned."
As with the employees incapacitated at the power plant, he saw no need to add any more deaths to what was already a long list. The woman killed while apprehending Soltani and Jen was an unfortunate accident, a careless act perpetrated by one of his men that Bukowski regretted. It was a mistake he vowed not to repeat, but for the moment he needed to keep up appearances. With that in mind, he turned his phaser rifle toward his prisoners.
"Don't make me regret that decision. Move!"
With the Starfleet officers leading the way, Bukowski and Fujimura once more headed for the docking slip. Bukowski saw that the transport that was their target appeared to be operational. As part of the sabotage plan, he had instructed Fujimura to ensure this ship was not affected by the massive power burst sent from the distribution plant. While the surge wreaked havoc with the Narbonne, the other transport, as well as the rest of the spaceport, and a significant portion of New Anchorage, this single ship was insulated from the attack. It was time to make use of their prize.
"Bukowski!"
shouted Islip from where he stood near the transport's forward boarding ramp.
"They're coming!"
There could be no mistaking the dark-haired man's agitation. Directing Jen and Soltani toward the ramp, Bukowski asked,
"Who?" "Scans show more than a dozen people coming from the Starfleet ship, and additional security forces are also coming. We can't hold all of them off forever." "We won't have to. What's the story on the Narbonne?"
Islip smiled.
"They're in bad shape. The surge hit them worse than we thought it would. They might get backup power systems up and running, but they won't be able to fly for at least an hour. Their warp drive was offline when they made planetfall, so that alone will take at least 30 minutes to bring back up. The other transport won't fly either. We've got an edge, but it won't last long."
Processing this, Bukowski liked what he was hearing. Their bold little scheme seemed to be working. They just needed to take it the rest of the way.
"How many hostages do we have?"
Gesturing toward the ramp, Islip replied,
"Counting those two? Five. The other three are maintenance workers."
"The Starfleet people will be more valuable, but I'll take what I can get."
Bukowski gestured to Fujimura.
"Get started."
Scowling, the computer tech replied,
"It could take a while. I don't know what kind of encryption or other lockouts they may have."
"It can't be too hard, because if it is, then we're all going to jail, assuming we don't die right here."
Making her way toward the boarding ramp, Fujimura glanced up at him.
"Hell of a pep talk, boss."
Bukowski looked at her with a wry grin.
"Better than the one you'll get from the warden of a Federation penal colony."
"Not helping."
"You'll be fine. Get to work."
From here, the plan was simple. Seize control of the transport and fly it out of here toward the mountains. Once there, they would pick up Kodos and the others and bid Tarsis IV farewell. The hostages were only really useful in securing their escape from the spaceport. Once Kodos and the others were aboard, Bukowski would put them off the ship, where they soon would be found by a search party. With the Narbonne and the other transport unable to give chase, the stolen transport would have a short interval of unchallenged warp speed travel that would allow them to make a couple of necessary course changes in order to obscure their flight path. This would hopefully be enough to throw off any pursuers until another ship or a place to hide could be secured. There were inhabited planets in neighboring star systems where such alternative transportation options were available, with few or no questions asked. Just a few more minutes. That was all Bukowski needed for Fujimura to work her magic and get him and his people out of here. Could they hold off the approaching security forces that long? For the first time, Bukowski considered the possibility of failure.
"I guess we'll see what we see."
30. It was the silence that woke Lorca. Having drifted to sleep, listening to the chirps, clicks, whistles, and other odd sounds emanating from local Tarsus IV insect life, along with the occasional report of some animal in the distance, the sudden lack of such ambient noise was enough to rouse him from slumber. His eyes open, he lay motionless while listening to the utter quiet now surrounding him. The moon was well past the midpoint in the sky, casting a faint bluish glow upon the area, and telling him that they were in the very early hours of a new day. His first thought, that someone had arisen to take care of personal hygiene needs, was dismissed when he realized that he could account for all the other 23 men and women comprising the search party. All but two were lying asleep, or at least motionless in their individual sleeping roles. The remaining two members of the Narbonne security detachment were walking on opposite sides of a large circle around the rest of the group. They were the watch, assigned a two-hour shift to look and listen for anything that might pose a threat to the team, ready to raise an alarm if and when they detected something. Neither of the two men seemed to be breaking from the routine they had established. Was he imagining things? No. The sound was faint, almost obscured by the gentle breeze blowing across the hillside, but he still heard it. It was from somewhere to his left, from a point farther along the sloping terrain than where the team made their camp. Something caught on a rock or stumbled into a hole before going quiet. Animals were seldom so clumsy, so that left only one real possibility. We've got company. Turning in his sleeping roll as though seeking a more comfortable position while still in the grips of slumber, Lorca attempted to get a better look up the hill. The moonlight was both an aid and a burden, playing tricks on his eyes as he searched the near darkness. He settled onto his left side with a line of sight toward the source of the sound. The motion allowed him to retrieve the phaser from where he placed it next to his right hip inside the blanket. From his new vantage point, he could also see nine members of the team, none of whom appeared to have responded to whatever it was he heard. Beyond them, there was nothing but uneven terrain and shadows. Then, in the distance, one of the shadows moved. It separated from a larger patch of black near a slab of rock protruding from the hillside, moving with deliberate slowness and stealth. Lorca's hand tightened around the phaser's grip, and he watched the shadow take on the form of a humanoid figure. A second one followed, moving a few paces behind its companion. Phaser fire sliced through the darkness, shattering the silence. Lorca flinched in response to the abrupt noise and flash of light, watching as the energy beam washed over the first of the intruders. A second shot followed, and he traced its source to one of the sleeping rolls to his right. Within seconds, both figures were neutralized, and other members of the team were reacting to the sudden explosion of activity. Throwing aside his own sleeping roll, Lorca pushed himself to his feet, aiming his phaser at the two intruders. He glanced to his right and saw Ensign Terry Bridges, phaser in hand, rising to one knee, and he realized it was she who had dispatched their unwanted visitors. "What?" she said. "Didn't you hear them?" The deadpan remark earned a smile from Lorca along with a nod of appreciation. "Nicely done." More weapons fire to his left made him turn to see one of the Narbonne security officers falling as a phaser beam struck him. Two others were firing toward the source of the attack, and two more shadowy figures dropped to the ground. "Secure the area!" Lorca recognized Lieutenant Reese O'Bannon shouting the order, followed by other instructions as he went about organizing the rest of the team and assessing the situation. "Spencer, get me a perimeter! Are there any more of these bastards running around out here?" Moving to the closest of the stunned intruders, Lorca saw that the man was wearing nondescript dark clothing designed to help him blend into his surroundings. A balaclava covered his face, and Lorca knelt beside the man to remove the mask. It revealed a dark-haired human of apparent Asian descent, his chin and jaw covered with beard stubble. He retrieved the man's phaser from where it had fallen next to his feet and frowned as he noted the weapon's power setting.
"Bridges," said Lorca, "get your medical kit. I want this one revived."
He looked up as O'Bannon approached, and Lorca noticed that the man, along with lacking his uniform jacket, was also barefoot. This made him realize that he was dressed in similar fashion, as was pretty much every member of the search party. The scene might have been amusing under normal circumstances.
"Commander," said O'Bannon.
He held out a rectangular device about twice the size of a standard-issue communicator.
"One of the intruders had it in a pocket. It's a frequency jammer, and it was active when we found it on him."
He nodded to where several of his people were moving about the camp's edges.
"It's why the tricorders we had on the perimeter didn't give us a warning."
Taking the proffered device, Lorca eyed it with disdain.
"Someone's crafty."
Bridges stepped between him and the unconscious man, having returned with her field medical kit. Cross-trained as a medic while still a cadet at Starfleet Academy, the ensign had kept up the necessary certifications and, like Asal Soltani, used her secondary skills to take care of the outpost team's minor medical needs. Without waiting for Lorca to instruct her further, Bridges extracted a hypospray from the kit and fitted it with an ampoule of a pale liquid. She pressed the device to the man's neck and administered the medication, and a moment later his eyes fluttered open. Lorca made sure the first thing he saw upon regaining consciousness was the power emitter of his own phaser.
"Welcome back."
To his credit, the man remained still, lying on his back and saying nothing, though his eyes widened as he recognized the weapon pointed at his face.
"What's your name?" asked Lorca.
"Kuzuko. Odaka Kuzuko."
Lorca leaned closer.
"Well, Odaka Kuzuko, we seem to have something of a problem. People sneaking around and trying to kill me tends to annoy me. Are you trying to annoy me?"
Raising his hands in a slow, deliberate manner to signify that he would not fight, Kuzuko said,
"Take it easy."
Lorca waved the captured phaser before the man's nose.
"Is it dark out here, or are my eyes just that bad, or is this weapon set to kill?"
He lowered his voice and made sure to add a touch of menace.
"It's yours, so I'm hoping you can tell me. Otherwise, I may have to test it."
"No need for that."
Kuzuko paused, swallowing as his gaze shifted between Lorca and the phaser hovering before his eyes.
"It's set to kill."
"See what I mean?"
Lorca tapped the phaser's emitter against the other man's forehead.
"Annoying."
Stepping away from him, he gestured for O'Bannon to help Kuzuko to his feet. The security officer stayed close, maintaining a grip on the man's arm.
"All right," said Lorca. "Who sent you? Or are you going to make me guess?"
Holding his hands away from his body to show he was not a threat, Kuzuko replied,
"Governor Kodo sent me."
"To kill us?"
asked Bridges.
Kuzuko was quick to answer.
"I was instructed to investigate intruders in the area and take whatever action I deemed necessary to protect our people."
"I've been shooting at friends of yours for the better part of 2 days, Mr. Kuzuko, and I haven't killed anybody. Not yet, anyway."
Lowering the phaser, Lorca stepped forward until mere centimeters separated his face from the other man's.
"On the other hand, you people have been quite busy with the killing, haven't you?"
"I didn't have anything to do with—"
Lorca pressed even closer, gritting his teeth.
"Don't even start!"
New rage was bubbling up within him, but he pushed it back down. It would do no good to lose control of his emotions and composure. For all he knew, this man was innocent, at least so far as participating in the massacre. Still, Kuzuko had already admitted to aiding Kodos, and that was enough to damn him in Lorca's eyes.
"Commander Lorca? Lieutenant O'Bannon?"
Moving back from Kuzuko, Lorca saw Ensign Dimitri Spencer walking toward them. He still carried his phaser pistol along with a tricorder. The blonde security officer held up the portable scanning device.
"We've checked the area, sir. There was only the four of them. The other three are in custody. We didn't find a vehicle, at least not as far as our tricorders can scan up here."
To Lorca, that last part was an unexpected bit of welcome news. Returning his attention to Kuzuko, he regarded the man with a grim smile.
"So you came on foot. I'm guessing your camp can't be too far from here."
Kuzuko did not have to answer. The way his eyes shifted from Lorca to the other people in his midst, as though searching for a potential weakness among the group or some avenue of escape, was a sufficient response. "Where's your camp?" asked O'Bannon, giving the other man's arm a small shake. Bridges said,
"Simmons was right, sir. Before, I mean, when you grilled him after what happened to Lieutenant Giler. Their camp can't be too far from here if they detected our presence. Or maybe they heard the explosion that killed the lieutenant. Either way, they have to be somewhere close."
"Lieutenant Giler," said Lorca, almost to himself, before turning back to Kuzico. "Who do we have to thank for the bomb that killed him?" Kuzico's eyes widened, his fear evident, and Lorca had his answer, which earned the other man a fresh look at his own phaser.
"Why?"
It was not a question, but instead a judgment. There was nothing the man could say that would ever justify the barbaric act that had taken Lieutenant Jason Giler's life. Kuzico knew that, just as he seemed to be realizing that he may well have sealed his own fate.
"It's a good thing I still need you."
Lorca gestured to O'Bannon. "Secure him with his friends, then get the rest of the team organized." He glanced at his chronometer. "We move out in 10 minutes. Traveling in the dark was not his first choice, but sooner or later Kuzico and his team would be missed, and Kodos, or whoever sent them, would take action. There was a very slim window of opportunity here, but Lorca and the others would have to move fast.
"Tell Simmons he's off the hook. Our new friend's going to lead the way."
31. Georgiou rolled away from her position atop the parapet overlooking the transport vessel's berth as phaser fire cut through the air over her head. The attack in her direction lasted only seconds before the torrent of energy beams swept to her right, raising the ground above and beyond the bay's confines.
"What the hell is that?" asked Haley Carroll.
The SCE engineer had thrown herself to the ground along the grassy embankment leading away from the parapet near Georgiou's left side. Her arms were over her head in what she and Georgiou knew was a futile gesture. Next to her, Ensign Dralax also lay flat, keeping his head away from the edge of the embankment.
"Phaser cannon," said Commander Larson from where she hunkered to Georgiou's right. "The ship has 4, 2 up top and 2 below. From where they're sitting, they can cover pretty much any ground attack."
Carol asked, "We're arming transport ships now? Did I miss a briefing?" "We're out on the frontier," said Georgiou. "A long way from Starfleet. If one of these transports runs into Orion pirates or some other rogue ship, they're on their own. More merchant captains are choosing to arm their ships." She ducked as the cannon fired again in their direction.
"Normally, I'd say there's nothing wrong with the idea. Ask me again tomorrow."
Georgiou split her attention between her companions and the docking slip as she studied the ship and the area surrounding it. Bathed in the light of bright work lamps positioned around the bay's edges, the transport was a dingy utilitarian affair. Essentially a squat rectangle with an angled forward hull section and a cylindrical warp nacelle tucked against either side of its main hull section, it was a design that dated back to the last decades of the 22nd century. Hull plates of different colors, many of them featuring an assortment of dents and scars, were patched together in an odd, dilapidated mosaic. On the other hand, the nacelles appeared to be of far more recent vintage, likely replacements as part of an upgrade to give the ship a more powerful warp drive capable of achieving greater speeds. The bay in which the transport was parked offered plenty of room for landing and takeoff, but it also prevented an approach by stealth. Anyone trying to get to the ship across the tarmac would be exposed and at the mercy of its phaser cannons, to say nothing of anyone on board who was also armed. That much was reflected in how the Narbonne and colony security people were reacting to the situation. All of them were keeping their heads down, and a handful were retreating away from the parapet, but it had become apparent to Georgiou that whoever was firing the phaser cannon was not seeking to kill or perhaps even hurt anyone. The barrage was meant to keep at bay anyone looking to advance on the transport. That, at least, gave her some hope that this situation could be resolved without further bloodshed. Moving away from the parapet's edge, down the embankment, and out of the line of fire, Georgiou looked to Larson. The Narbonne's first officer was consulting a tricorder in her hand.
"What's going on?"
"Their engines are online," replied Larson. They're preparing for liftoff.
Carol asked, Do we know how many people are aboard?
I picked up 8 distinct life signs. 7 human, 1 betazoid.
Larson's expression conveyed she was thinking the same thing as Georgiou.
Lieutenant Jen?
Probably,
Larson grimaced.
Standing next to Carol, Dreylak said, She and Soltani were at the distribution plant where the power surge originated.
They must have been taken hostage, added Georgiou.
That'd explain why we haven't been able to reach them.
Damn it.
Though Georgiou was buoyed by the knowledge that the 2 Starfleet officers had not been killed at the power plant, it complicated the immediate problem. The people seizing the transport seemed restrained with their actions against anyone standing in their way. If they felt pressured, cornered, or otherwise out of options, they would almost certainly use their hostages as leverage to achieve their ends. Asal Soltani and Inamori Jen were far from being out of danger. Down in the docking slips, the transport's engines were powering up, their increasing hum growing louder thanks to the bay's natural acoustics.
We can't let that ship take off, said Georgiou. And we sure as hell can't stay here if it does.
Thrusters designed to thwart a planet's gravity and lift the craft towards space would be more than powerful enough to kill anyone in proximity to the ship.
Larson replied, There's no way to keep it on the ground. If we had the Narbonne, then maybe, but they're a half hour from being ready to launch.
And we can't assault the ship directly.
Georgiou looked around, searching for anything else the spaceport might offer to thwart the transport's pending liftoff.
Is there a working transporter around here somewhere?
The ones on the Narbonne are the only ones I'd trust, but after that power surge, I wouldn't want to try them without running a full diagnostic.
Pulling her communicator from her belt, Georgiou flipped open the unit's cover.
Georgiou to Narbonne.
Kurapati here, replied the voice of the ship's captain.
Her attention still focused on the ship below, Georgiou said,
What's the status of your transporters, sir?
They're online, but engineering hasn't run full checks on them.
I need someone to beam me onto that transport.
Larson regarded her with disbelief.
Are you insane?
Ask me that tomorrow, too.
Over the open comm frequency, Kurapati said,
Commander, that's a risky proposition, at best.
We are out of options if we want to keep that ship here. If I can get aboard, I can force them to abort takeoff or get them back on the ground.
Assuming they're open to negotiation, offered Larson.
Georgiou replied,
Then I'll find a way to disable it.
Hold on, said Carol. I think I can go one better.
I'm listening, said Kurapati.
Carol grabbed her arm.
No time for that. Come on!
Sprinting for the small building near the docking area's entrance, Carol was the first through the doorway, and Georgiou saw upon entering that it was a small guardhouse. It was a single room with 2 workstations, each with computer interface terminals, communications equipment, and other components she did not recognize.
Lieutenant Carol?
She prompted, watching as the engineer settled herself at one of the workstations.
I think I can take remote control of the transport.
What?
The immediate absurdity of the notion gripped her for a second or two, then Georgiou waved off her initial reaction as she realized where Carol was going.
Prefix code access?
Carol, already setting to work at the console, nodded.
That's the idea.
But don't you need the code?
The question came from Larson, who had arrived at the guardhouse. Georgiou looked to see the first officer and Dreylax watching her and Carol from the doorway. Turning from the console just long enough to flash a knowing smile, Carol replied,
This isn't exactly something they teach at the Academy, Commander. Join the SCE, and we can show you all kinds of tricks.
I'm only interested in one, said Georgiou.
Beyond the guardhouse's walls, she could hear the drone of the transport's engines continuing to increase.
How long is this going to take?
If the transport is still linked to the spaceport's communications and computer network array, only a minute or so, replied Carol. I can use that to patch into the ship's onboard computer. Once I'm past the security encryption, I'll have full access. Thankfully, the systems on these civilian ships aren't as tough as Starfleet computers.
Commander, called Ensign Dreylax.
The transport is lifting off.
Moving to the doorway, Giorgio peered outside the guardhouse as the rumble from the docking berth grew even louder. Shadows shifted along the embankment leading up to the parapet overlooking the bay as the transport rose into view. With her hand resting on the edge of the door, she felt the guardhouse's walls trembling in the face of the ship's powerful atmospheric thrusters.
"Larson to Narbonne," the first officer called into her communicator. "Are you seeing this? The transport's launching! We need to track it for as long as possible!"
Through the device's speaker grill, Giorgio heard Koropati say,
"We are on it, Commander, but we are not yet back to full strength. If they leave the atmosphere, we may be out of luck."
Gritting her teeth as she watched the transport climb higher into the night sky, its silhouette bathed in a pale blue moonlight, Giorgio said,
"Carol, where are we?"
"Working on it, Commander."
A moment later, the engineer released a string of obscenities, human, Andorian, Tellarite, and a few Giorgio did not recognize.
"They've severed their link with the spaceport and blocked their communications. I can't get in."
Her mind racing as she watched the transport rising higher into the sky, Giorgio said,
"What if comm was re-established? I just need any open frequency, but it has to be done from on..."
The rest of the sentence faded, and she looked up from the station.
"Oh, wait."
Ignoring her, Giorgio said into her communicator,
"Captain, it's now or never. Requesting immediate transport to that ship. I understand the risks, but if we don't try, we lose Jen and Sotani anyway."
If the worst happened, her own life would be just one more casualty of this entire tragic affair, but that at least was preferable to doing nothing and consigning two fellow Starfleet officers to almost certain death. Was there really another choice?
His voice somber over the open channel, Koropati said, "Stand by for transport."
"We're up," reported the pilot from the transport's cramped cockpit. "Doesn't look like anybody's trying to chase us."
From where she sat in one of the four seats positioned in a section of deck behind the pilot and co-pilot stations, Inamori Jen watched as the man tasked with flying the ship, she had learned his name, Benjamin Islip, after probing his thoughts, moved his hands over the helm console and its various clusters of controls. Somewhere behind her, the transport's engines were rumbling under restrained power, while the ship relied on thrusters to maneuver the ungainly craft while still within the planet's atmosphere. Beyond the cockpit's canopy, she could see flashes of light as the transporter lifted away from the spaceport, but she was not sensing the sort of acceleration needed for the ship to escape the planet's gravity and head for open space. Of course, Jen knew that was not Pekaski's objective. At least not yet. Standing behind Islip, Pekaski said,
"Well, don't get too comfortable. You know they'll be trying to track us on sensors. So long as we're down here, they'll know where we are."
The woman seated next to Islip, Hisayo Fujimura, said,
"Yeah, I'm already seeing that from the Starfleet ship."
She released a loud sigh.
"I have to give them credit. They're shaking off the power surge faster than I thought they would."
"You don't really think you can get away without them being able to follow you, do you?" asked Sultani.
Like Jen, he sat in his seat with his wrists still restrained behind his back. Pekaski patted a nearby bulkhead with the flat of his hand.
"There's a reason we picked this ship. Unlike the other transport, this baby can get up to warp 7. Your ship can only hit warp 6. Once we reach our initial destination, we'll just disappear."
The man's confidence radiated from him as it had from the moment he and his people took her and Sultani hostage, but it was almost suffocating to her in the confined space. She already knew his plan, having retrieved it from his thoughts. Everything he knew, at least, as it appeared he did not possess knowledge of all of the scheme's various parts. He did not know the ship's destination after leaving Tarsus IV, and Jen read his irritation at having that information kept from him by Kodos. She was tempted to talk to him about it and perhaps unsettle him with the knowledge he had unknowingly given her. There was little to be gained from that, and certainly not enough to justify revealing her abilities and putting herself and Sultani at risk. In addition to her and Sultani, They also had three workers from the spaceport, restrained to seats in the compartment behind the cockpit and under guard by the other two members of Pekaski's team. According to Pekaski's thoughts, he intended to leave all five of his prisoners behind once the transport arrived at its destination in the mountains east of New Anchorage. There they would pick up the rest of their people, including Kodos. What he did not know was that his partner, Fujimura, harbored no qualms about killing not just the hostages, but him as well, if he got in her way, or if she believed he represented a threat to her. Perhaps this was something Jen could use to her and Soltani's advantage, and somehow pit Pekaski against Fujimura. "Hang on," said Fujimura. She pointed to an alert indicator on the cockpit console. "Internal sensors just registered an incoming transporter beam." Pekaski grunted in obvious irritation.
"Are you sure?"
"Of course I'm sure." The woman did not bother to hide her disdain for the other man. Exchanging looks with Soltani, Jen sensed her companion's surprise and renewed hope that the situation could be changing in their favor. She also detected his concern that this development might cause their captors to take rash action against the prisoners. Pekaski retrieved his phaser rifle from the deck beside his chair, and Jen watched him check its power setting. Pushing himself from his seat, he eyed her and Soltani before casting a look toward the cockpit.
"Stay here. I'll check it out. Keep your eyes on our friends."
"Go!" snapped Fujimura. "We've got this!" When the woman glared over her shoulder, Jen felt contempt radiating from her, but she also registered Fujimura's growing worry. The unexpected arrival of an intruder in their midst would be at the very least a distraction from the mission they were attempting to complete. There was also the first hint of desperation creeping into the other woman's thoughts, and Jen knew this might make her unpredictable and perhaps even dangerous.
"Some of your friends are trying to be cute,"
said Pekaski, staring at Jen as though able to read her thoughts. Gripping the phaser rifle in both hands, he began moving to the cockpit's rear access hatch.
"They're gonna wish they'd just left us alone."
32. Georgiou braced herself against the wave of dizziness that accompanied the fading of the transporter beam. The room around her reeled, and she reached with her free hand to steady herself against a nearby bulkhead. Her other hand lifted her phaser, aiming the weapon in front of her as she searched her immediate surroundings for threats. For now, and she knew the moment was fleeting, she was alone. The Narbonne's transporter officer had executed her transfer from the spaceport to the fleeing vessel with pinpoint precision, depositing Georgiou in one corner of a cargo bay. Packing containers of various sizes were shelved or stacked and secured to the deck around her, but the area in which she arrived was open space and yet protected on all sides either by bulkheads or cargo. None of that would matter if anyone was monitoring the ship's internal sensors, but at least there was no one waiting to shoot her the instant she finished materializing. She stood motionless for a moment, verifying that she was alone in the compartment. The transport's engines droned with power, and the walls and deck carried a small yet noticeable vibration as the vessel continued its ascent toward orbit. There seemed to be no one else within earshot. With the last lingering effects of vertigo still gripping her, she fumbled for her communicator. She flipped it open, and the unit's telltale chirp sounded like an alarm siren in the otherwise quiet bay.
"Georgiou to Carol."
It took only a moment for the engineer to respond.
"I'm here, Commander. Glad you made it aboard okay."
"What do I do?"
Emerging from her place of concealment behind the stacks of cargo containers, Georgiou kept her phaser out and pointed ahead of her. Carol replied,
"Find a comm panel or computer interface, anything that'll let you open a hailing frequency directed away from the ship."
It took Georgiou only a moment to find what appeared to be an office tucked into another corner of the bay. Inside was a simple desk with one end mounted to a bulkhead and playing host to a simple computer terminal which she was relieved to see was operational.
"I've found a terminal," she said, setting her phaser on the desk so that she could activate the desktop interface.
The unit's screen flashed in response to her commands, its display coalescing into a menu of options, and she tapped one that indicated access to the ship's communications system.